hospitals across the state and the whole U.S. In California, only 3% of ICU beds are available. In the 11-county Southern California region, no ICU beds are open, and in San Juan Valley, just 0.7% were. The county of Los Angeles, the nation's largest, was perilously close to zero capacity. County health officials reported that the number of daily new COVID-19 cases, deaths, and hospitalizations had all soared beyond their previous highs for the entire pandemic. LAC plus USC has had a heavy COVID-19 burden since the beginning of the pandemic, largely because the low-income, predominantly Latino community it serves has been hit so hard. Latinos represent about 39% of California's population, but have accounted for nearly 57% of the state's COVID cases and 48% of its COVID deaths, according to data updated this week. Many people who live near the hospital have essential jobs and are not able to work home. They are going out there and exposing themselves because they have to make a living, Spielberg said. And he said they don't live in giant houses where they can isolate themselves in a room. The worst cases end up lying amid a tangle of tubes and bags in ICU rooms designed to prevent air and viral practices from flowing out into the hall. The sickest among them, like the woman described, need machines to breathe for them. They are fed through nose tubes, their bladders draining into catheter bags, while intravenous lines deliver fluids and medications to relieve pain, keep them sedated and raise their blood pressure to a level necessary for life. To take some pressure off the ICUs, the hospital opened a new step down recently for patients who are still very sick but can be managed with a slightly lower level of care. Spielberg said he hopes the unit will accommodate up to 10 patients. Hospital staff members have also been scouring the insurance plans of patients to see if they can be transferred to other hospitals. But at this point, it's become almost impossible because they're all filling up, Spielberg said. 2 weeks ago, a smaller percentage of COVID-19 patients in the ER were showing signs of severe disease, which meant fewer needed to be admitted to the hospital or ICU than during the July surge. That was helping, as Spielberg put it, to keep the water below the top of the levee. But not anymore. Over the last 10 days, it is the distinct impression that the severity has worsened again, and that's why ICU has filled up quickly, Spielberg recently said. The total number of COVID-19 patients in the hospital and the number in its ICUs are now well above the peak of July, and both are nearly six times as high as in late October. This is the worst it's been, Spielberg said. And it will only get worse over the coming weeks, he added, if people travel and gather in their extended families over Christmas and New Year's as they did for the Thanksgiving. They are already bad enough. Nurses and other medical staffers are exhausted from long months of extremely patient care that is only getting more intense, said Lee Salinas, a nurse manager in one of the hospital's ICU units. To avoid being short of staff, she's been asking her nurses to work overtime. Normally, ICU nurses are assigned to two patients each shift, but one really sick COVID-19 patient can take up virtually the entire shift, even with help from other nurses. Jonathan Magadilna, a registered nurse in the ICU, said he might have to spend 10 hours during 12-hour shift at the bedside of an extremely ill patient. Even in the best case, he said, he typically has to enter a patient's room every 30 minutes because the bags delivering medications and fluids empty at different rates. Every time nurses or other care providers enter a patient's room, they must put on cumbersome protective gear, then take it off when they leave. One of the most delicate and difficult tasks is a maneuver known as proning, in which a patient in acute respiratory distress is flipped onto his or her stomach to improve lung function. Selena said it can take half hour and require up to 6 nurses and a respiratory therapist because tubes and wires have to be disconnected, then reconnected, not to mention the risks involved in moving an extremely fragile person. And they must do it twice because every prone patient needs to be flipped back later in the day. That the darkest hour of the pandemic should come precisely at the moment when COVID-19 vaccines are beginning to arrive is especially poignant, said Dr. Paul Holton, chief epidemiologist at LAC Plus USC. The tragic irony of this is that the light is at the end of the tunnel, he said. The vaccine is rolling out as we speak, and people just need to keep themselves alive until they can get the vaccine.
European News Bulletin.
From London, plenty to cover in this half hour, and we will begin here in the UK. Well, after 9 months of negotiations that have crashing through deadline after deadline, the United Kingdom and Europe have finally reached an agreement over security and trade, so Britain can finally end its EU membership. The announcement was made after round-the-clock talks aimed at getting a deal before December 31st. Now the 2,000-page document must be sold to Parliament and the British public, and businesses must start adjusting to the new ways of trading.
Christmas Eve 2020, Prime Minister Boris Johnson signed off on an historic post-Brexit trade and security agreement with the European Union after an intense 24-hour negotiation period. A press conference expected early in the day finally came in the afternoon after lawyers and translators had crossed all the T's and dotted all the I's.
I'm very pleased to tell you this afternoon that we have completed the biggest trade deal yet, worth £660 billion. A year, a comprehensive Canada-style free trade deal between the UK and the EU, a deal that will protect jobs across this country, a deal that will allow goods, UK goods and components to be sold without tariffs and without quotas in the EU market, a deal which will, if anything, allow our companies and our exporters to do even more business with our European friends.
A deal will mean Britain finally leaving the bloc's single market and customs union in a week, and freedom of movement will end. It also settles the future arrangements on a vast range of issues, from aviation and transport to civil nuclear cooperation and energy. The sticking points that took Brexit to the brink of no deal was access to British fishing waters, a contentious issue that prompted the UK to send Navy ships to the English Channel in case of clashes, and the level playing field, which is an important part of the EU single market, allowing for fair and open competition. The negotiations were very difficult, with lots at stake for many, and it was an agreement worth fighting for. will allow us to avoid major disruptions to workers, businesses and travellers after January 1st. It will protect European interests, and this agreement is also, I believe, in the interests of the United Kingdom. It will lay solid foundations for a new start with long-time friends, and finally, it will ensure we can leave Brexit behind us. Europe continues to move forward. Despite the collective sighs of relief and resignation across Britain, the devil is in the detail. French media made waves in the hours leading up to it by asserting the UK had made huge concessions, something Westminster was quick to deny. Hardline Tory Brexiteers from the European Research Group have said its star chamber of lawyers will be convened to analyse the proposed agreement, suggesting it's not over yet. Bianca Rahimi, London.
All right, let's cross over to Westminster. Robert Carter is standing by. Robert, not really the kind of bluster that we heard the British Prime Minister a year ago give the British public. And everybody said if there was going to be a deal, there has to be a compromise or a fudge. Which of the two sides do you think has made that compromise?
Well, I think that the British Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, will take this as a form of victory. He did promise that he would get Brexit done and indeed secure that trade deal in order to finalise Brexit and to move on. However, the issue of compromise and who backed down, who are the winners and who are the losers, is being asked by journalists, particularly in the Q&A section after his announcement speech. And Boris Johnson seems to try to avoid mentioning where the UK has compromised to the best of his ability. So ultimately, the inquisition has now begun. Journalists, as well as legal experts and politicians, will be poring over the details. The overall document is believed to be about 500 pages or so, according to the British Prime Minister. So it won't be such a lengthy read as we originally suspected, but ultimately there are still room for criticism to be highlighted, especially from perhaps radical elements within his own Conservative Party, the hardline Brexiteers, who are going to be poring over the fine print to see if there are any major compromises that have been made that they don't like. But ultimately, areas like the fisheries, it seems as if the UK is claiming a victory there. That was a major contentious issue. But also, where will Northern Ireland be left after this trade agreement? And what relationship will they have in terms of trading with the UK? That could be a major issue, and we have to see the details regarding that as well. But ultimately, Boris Johnson is claiming victory here. The EU admitted that they were sad at the situation that we find ourselves in, but both sides seem adamant that the coronavirus is having massive economic impact on both sides, and I think they both want to get Brexit out of the way now.
All right, Robert Carter at Westminster for us. Robert, thank you. Moving on now. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has met with U.S. Ambassador to the UN, Kelly Kraft, in Jerusalem al-Quds as part of an official visit. Netanyahu used the opportunity to thank the outgoing Trump administration for its, quote, defense of Israel. While in office, Trump recognized Jerusalem al-Quds as Israel's capital and moved the American embassy there, whilst also declaring the illegally occupied Syrian Golan Heights as Israeli territory. Both moves were condemned by the United Nations and the European Union. The meeting comes one day after Israeli regime's unity coalition collapsed, triggering the fourth election in 2 years. The fractured political landscape has meant no outright candidate is able to secure a clear majority. Be right back. Rising tensions between Iran and the U.S. Outgoing American President Donald Trump threatening Iran with war. Just how serious is the situation? Let's bring in Robert Inlakesh, who's been following that story for us. And Robert, this is a president known for being erratic, for being prone to making unexpected moves. What do you think of the whole thing?
Absolutely, and Trump is someone that's a bit of a wild card. You can't really read him. So to say that he would or would not commit an attack against Iran really would be silly. So looking at the situation, we do know that Trump has a track record of lying about responding to Iran, as he calls it. After the assassination of Haji Qasem Soleimani, Iran's top general, the response that Iran gave by hitting Ain al-Assad base, Trump stated that he'd hit 50-plus sites, including cultural targets inside of Iran as a response to that, but Bakhtalkhan did nothing. Again, the U.S. military have positioned itself with, of course, placing a nuclear submarine into the Persian Gulf, being doing these flyovers over the Middle East with these B-52 bombers, etc. But meanwhile, back inside of the United States, the U.S. government has stated it does not seek war. Trump, though, last night just tweeted out photos of rockets which were launched, a number of them were launched on Sunday against the U.S. embassy in Baghdad. And he was essentially trying to link Iran and blame Iran for this attack when these attacks happen all the time. They've happened frequently this year, especially after the assassination of Qasem Soleimani and also Abu Mehdi al-Mohandes of the PMU. And so to link this to Iran is ridiculous propaganda.
What is the purpose of it all, Robert, very briefly? Is this about, as one Iranian official has been saying, distracting everybody from the fact that he's lost the election?
That could be part of it. Another, also, it's also speculated that perhaps Donald Trump does want to open up escalations inside of the Middle East with Iran specifically to basically put Joe Biden in a weak position to negotiate to get back into the JCPOA, and also maybe to stay remain in as U.S. president for a little bit longer.
All right, let's hear some public opinion on this.
The first one we have commenting on this here is a tweet here we got from a user called Steven, who says, "Friendly reminder before Trump does whatever crazy thing he's about to do to Iran. This is all his fault. He inherited a working diplomatic nuclear deal and thawing relations, blew that all up to try out maximum pressure, which predictably failed. And now here we are yet again." Another one here as well commenting on this, who says, "Make no mistake, Trump has already moved B-52s, submarines, and other military assets into the Persian Gulf. He is planning to start a war with Iran on bogus charges in order to prevent Biden from taking office. Iran is not the real target. American democracy is."
All right. Let's move on to your second pick of the trending stories. Robert, after it withdrew its envoy to Israel in May 2018, over deadly attacks on the Palestinians in besieged Gaza, Turkey has appointed a new envoy to the occupied territories just a little over a week ago. Is this a thaw in relations, and what's the purpose of it all?
Well, it does seem that Turkey is perhaps moving away from its tight relationship that it had in the past with Israel. But when we look at Turkey as a regional power, it's very unpredictable, like Donald Trump, really. There is, of course, the pro-Erdogan power base inside of the country, but there's also opposition to this as well. Erdogan is seen to have, to want to really expand Turkey's influence, to expand the influence of the country in general and his regime over the Sunni Muslim world, and sort of lead it and take on over from Saudi Arabia. And so what we've seen him do lately is really speak up a lot to the United Nations and other respective forums on behalf of the Palestinian people. The withdrawal of the ambassador in May 2018, again, was in response to a massacre of over 60 Palestinians on the same day that the U.S. embassy was relocated to Jerusalem al-Quds. And so this new ambassador is a pro-Erdogan ambassador, but at the same time, it's hard to predict what Turkey will do. At one minute, it's friends with Israel. The next minute, it's.
What do you say? Very briefly, to those who say that the path to Washington goes through Jerusalem or Tel Aviv, whatever you want to call it, Erdogan had good relations with Trump, but probably not so when Biden comes to power, and because of given Israel's and Netanyahu's influence in the quarters of power in Washington, he is sort of pandering to Israel at the moment.
Absolutely. So we've seen as well, for instance, in Barack Obama's newest book, that he spoke about how Erdogan was difficult because of the fact that he was so pro-Palestinian, and this presented a real huge problem in terms of relations with Turkey. And so, of course, this is a major thing. Even Russia, of course, it has a strong relationship with Israel. And to get to Washington and also to manage your policy in the Middle East, you have to, in some way, if you're one of these big powers, cooperate with Israel if you're looking to please the United States.
Let's see what this move by Turkey, what kind of reaction it's got from social media users.
The first comment we pulled up here is saying that Turkey was the first Muslim country to accept Israel, but recently Turkey withdrew their ambassador from Tel Aviv. It's better that Turkey are taking a stand now more than most Arab countries. We Pakistanis hate the policies of Israel. We won't ever accept the invaders. Very strong comments there. And we got another one here from a user called Ahmed who says, just watch, Turkey will change its mind on its newly adopted harsher approach to Israel as soon as the price is right. Turkey has no principles. It acts like a European country. It looks out for itself first and does not stick to a solid foundation.
All right, Robert Nalakesh with those stories. Robert, thank you. To other news, a huge fire has destroyed a refugee camp in Bosnia. The camp had been criticized by rights groups because of its inadequate facilities and lack of resources. According to the UN, the fire started minutes after the camp was closed, leaving 1,400 men, women, and children stranded. There were no casualties or injuries, but the infrastructure of the site near the village of Lipa was destroyed. The fire comes months after the EU criticized Bosnian authorities for failing to provide enough protection for the tens of thousands of refugees who passed through the camp to reach neighboring European nations.
This is European News Bulletin broadcast by IRIB English Radio. In this program, we covered the most recent developments all over Europe.
Following the Moscow-brokered peace deal between Armenia and Azerbaijan, the Russian Emergency Ministry has announced it has begun donating humanitarian aid to residents of Nagorno-Karabakh.
Today, the Russian Emergency Ministry has unloaded and delivered to Nagorno-Karabakh another 9 wagons of humanitarian aid, including construction and roofing materials, basic commodities, as well as electric generators and firefighters' vehicles.
On the 27th of September 2020, bloody clashes in the Nagorno-Karabakh region resumed, leading to a six-week-long bloody war that resulted in the death of over 5,600 soldiers and civilians. The fighting ended after the two sides agreed to a ceasefire. Russia has deployed nearly 2,000 peacekeepers for at least 5 years to monitor the agreement and facilitate the return of refugees. While the British government spends its time consumed by post-Brexit relations with the European Union and by the pandemic, issues which literally mean life or death for some people have gone largely ignored. One such issue is poverty. Charity organization Trussell Trust says that during the first 6 months of the pandemic, it distributed more than 1 million food packages. 470,000 of them went to families with children. And it looks like those numbers are on the rise. Karina was a working mom with a job in the tourism sector, decimated by the pandemic. With no savings to fall back on, and with her husband's delivery job earnings nowhere near enough for them to get by, they ended up in a position no one wants to find themselves.
I never knew about food bank. I just found out since I was on a financial difficulty.
Karina's quest for help led her to Educare Family Support Service, one of many publicly funded companies helping families down on their luck in the age of COVID.
We have lots of different food items that will go in. The plan behind it was that we would be able to prepare hampers for families, who disadvantaged families who may not be able to afford to have a Christmas meal or Boxing Day meal. So we've ensured that we've provided a hamper with everything excluding the meat. At the moment, we're on about 270. Literally, that is 270 families.
270 of many more families facing food insecurity and hunger, exacerbated by the pandemic, a situation that's drawn in UNICEF for the first time in its 70-year history in this country.
in these unprecedented times. I would imagine that these families have become known to the professionals that they're engaging with and are now require additional support.
This cavernous space is the interior of an Anglican church in West London. In normal times, it would see worshippers kneeling in prayer. Today, it's dedicated to something more pressing, getting food into people's cupboards.
I've got quite emotional, actually, about, you know, just the thought that you're privileged and get to enjoy Christmas and then other people are going without, especially at the moment with these troubled times. So I thought if I can come and make just a little bit of difference.
These hampers are being stuffed with supplies to last families for a few days. People used to go to food banks to pick them up. Since the onset of COVID, the whole project of compassion has taken on a new dimension, deliveries.
These volunteer drivers will be dropping off food and presents at hundreds of households for the next 3 days. A drop in the bucket considering the number of families depending on these supplies. And some of those families have up to 6 children.
Most of these volunteers found out about this project on social media. Some of them have dedicated their only day off to being here.
To see the family smiles and the people who need the things is, you know, I can't explain what you feel. The smile of them faces just can give me the energy. They can make my day.
Some have brought their young ones along so they can see firsthand what their less fortunate peers are going through. Those with bigger vehicles have come as couples to help transport more of this humanitarian assistance to homes where kitchen cabinets are not restocked as often as they should.
It's nothing for me to offer a couple of hours, so we are also in a position where it could be me who needs this support.
This year has been very contrasting in the fact that there's some people just getting richer and richer and richer, and we're reaching rock bottom, really, in sense of community is getting destroyed, really.
If you're feeding a family of 4 to 6 people, that's going to last, 2 days. It will get them through till Christmas Eve, hopefully.
And we all think we're struggling. Karina has had to adapt to her new world, caring for her 3-year-old daughter in a small rented apartment with no garden while her husband works, and looking after her ailing father who lives on his own.
I know a lot of people are suffering during this difficult time. It's very challenging, but you have to be positive at all times. Seek for help. If you don't ask, you don't get it.
Karina is perhaps one of the tens of thousands of families, if not more, for whom survival depends on charitable donations. Saeed Bouriza, London.
Yet another black man killed at the hands of U.S. police, this time in Columbus, Ohio, earlier this month. The city's mayor is now calling for the immediate termination of the officer who fatally shot Andre Hill. Richard Sedan has all the details. And Richard, thank heavens for body cameras.
Indeed. I mean, one of the interesting aspects to this case is that the officer accused of killing Andre Hill, Adam Coy, has been accused of having the audio off in footage of the incident. But the reality is this is another black man dead at the hands of the police in the U.S. who was unarmed. And actually, this is the second killing in recent weeks within the Columbus area in Ohio. Of course, we saw the fatal shooting of Casey Goodson in recent days. Now, everyone, Saeed, is talking about video of the incident, which has gone viral.
And all that man was carrying, Richard, was a cell phone.
Absolutely. There's been no gun retrieved by the authorities, in the area of the incident. And again, just to reiterate, there was no sound during that picture because there's a question about why the sound was actually turned off on the body cam. So there's a lot of questions being asked. The community is already starting to rally. A lot of people are asking the question, how are the police allowed to carry out these killings? Where's the accountability? Where's the outcry? And actually, Andre Hill was left basically dead on the floor. The police didn't even attend to him at the scene when they should have. And again, this has potentially broken more rules and more laws. But again, Saeed, this is almost an epidemic. We are seeing this take place again and again and again in the US. And I think we're going to see this trend continue, unfortunately, into the new year. And as we see Donald Trump's reign in the US come to an end, and as he begins the process of vacating the White House. So deeply disturbing, worrying times for black Americans right now, particularly in the Ohio area.
We sure are going to see more of this happen, and I'm positive you'll be keeping an eye on those and bringing us whatever that goes down in that country. I'm being told we have time for only one tweet, Richard.
In which case, let's go to Jill Lewis on Twitter, who says, the cop who murdered Andre Hill had 82 complaints against him. He was suspended for 6 months once, and the city paid $45,000 to one of his victims 5 years ago. We need that civilian review board, because Columbus Police and the FOP won't clean their own house, and I see many similar tweets like this on this topic, Saeed.
All right, Richard Sedan with that story. Richard, thank you. And that does it for this broadcast from London. Goodbye.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Limelight. President Donald Trump approved a wave of pre-Christmas pardons, granting clemency to a former campaign aide caught up in the Russia investigation, disgraced Republican lawmakers, and several contractors convicted of massacring Iraqi civilians in Baghdad. The White House announced on Tuesday, 22nd of December, Trump has granted full pardons to 15 people and commuted all or part of the sentences of 5 others. The beneficiaries include George Papadopoulos, a former campaign aide who pleaded guilty to lying to federal officials as part of the investigation into Russian interference in the 2016 presidential election, and Alex van der Zwaan, who pleaded guilty to a similar charge in the Russia investigation and is the son-in-law of Russian billionaire German Khan. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian journalists Martin Pengelly and Manvi Singh. The piece is titled Trump Pardons Ex-Campaign Aide, Blackwater Contractors, and Disgraced Lawmakers. Stay with us for more of Martin Pengelly and Manvi Singh's article. President Donald Trump approved a wave of pre-Christmas pardons, granting clemency to a former campaign aide caught up in the Russia investigation, disgraced Republican lawmakers, and several contractors convicted of massacring Iraqi civilians. The White House announced on Tuesday, 22nd of December, that Trump has granted full pardons to 15 people and commuted all or part of the sentences of 5 others. The beneficiaries include George Papadopoulos, a former campaign aide who pleaded guilty to lying to federal officials as part of the investigation into Russian interference in the 2016 presidential election, and Alex van der Zwaan, who pleaded guilty to a similar charge in the Russia investigation and is the son-in-law of the Russian billionaire German Khan. The three former Republican U.S. representatives who were pardoned or had their sentences commuted on Tuesday were Chris Collins of New York, Duncan Hunter of California, and Steve Stockman of Texas. Chris Collins, a 70-year-old, had been the first sitting member of Congress to endorse Trump's candidacy in 2016 and was a strong defender of the president. He pleaded guilty to conspiring to commit securities fraud and making false statements to the FBI and received a full pardon from Donald Trump. Duncan Hunter of California, a 44-year-old, pleaded guilty in 2019 to conspiring to convert campaign funds for personal use and received a full pardon. Steve Stockman of Texas, a 64-year-old, was convicted in 2018 of misuse of charitable funds and had his sentence commuted after serving 2 of 10 years. Also pardoned were Nicholas Slatton, Paul Slough, Evan Liberty, and Dustin Hurd, former contractors at Blackwater Worldwide, who were serving lengthy prison terms in connection with the massacring of Iraqi civilians in a 2007 massacre in Baghdad, the Iraqi capital. Among those killed by the Blackwater contractors were children, including a 9-year-old Iraqi boy and a mother who was clutching an infant. Two former Border Patrol agents were also among those pardoned. Ignacio Ramos and Jose Compian were found guilty of crimes related to shooting an unarmed man who was smuggling drugs in 2005. George W. Bush commuted their sentences in 2009, but did not grant a full pardon. President Donald Trump's use of the presidential pardon power has attracted considerable controversy, and a list of recipients on Tuesday drew strong rebuke from Democrats. "These corrupt politicians don't deserve a pardon," said the Democratic California Representative Katie Porter. "Appalling decision by the president. Are you still a pro-law enforcement president after you pardoned killers of a 9-year-old Iraqi boy and an 11-year-old, asked Joy Salim, a law professor at the University of Alabama and former U.S. attorney for the Northern District of Alabama, about the decision in the contractor's case. Adam Schiff, the Democratic congressman who prosecuted Donald Trump's impeachment trial, tweeted, "Lie to cover up for the president, you get a pardon. Corrupt politician who endorsed Trump, you get a pardon. Murder innocent Iraqi civilians, you get a pardon. Elect a corrupt man as president, you get a corrupt result." While remarkable, Tuesday's wave of decisions did not come as a surprise. Back in November, Donald Trump pardoned his former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn, who pleaded guilty to lying to the FBI investigators during the Russia investigation. Speculation has flourished about whom Donald Trump may pardon next. The pardoning of George Papadopoulos and Alex van der Zwaan may signal that more Trump associates embroiled in the matter could expect pardons, including his former aides Paul Manafort and Rick Gates. Donald Trump's attorney Rudy Giuliani, the WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange, and the National Security Agency whistleblower Edward Snowden are also among names commonly mentioned. today's pardon helps correct the wrong that Robert Mueller's team inflicted on so many people, the White House said in a statement. George Papadopoulos, a 33-year-old, was an advisor to Donald Trump's 2016 election campaign. He pleaded guilty in 2017 to lying to FBI agents about the timing and significance of his contacts with people who claimed to have ties to top Russian officials. The defendant's crime was serious and caused damage to the government's investigation into Russian interference in the 2016 presidential election, a sentencing recommendation memo from the then U.S. Special Counsel Robert Mueller said. George Papadopoulos served only 12 days of a 14-day sentence in federal prison, then was placed on a 12-month supervised release. It has also been reported that President Donald Trump has considered issuing a preemptive pardon for himself and also for members of his family who have worked in his White House.
Internet trolls. The Internet. What began as an exclusive tool to connect militaries, governments, and then universities has now, more than 60 years later, transformed everything about how modern societies operate and communicate. Today, no one can escape the grasp of social media or evade the mind-boggling connectivity that nearly all humans worldwide now have access to. But few have been prepared for what has also emerged with all this human connectedness. A new and ominous strain of human behavior has been unleashed. Increasingly, people are hiding behind a cloak of anonymity, waiting to provoke, harass, and even threaten anyone they choose. They are called Internet trolls.
A troll is someone devoting large parts of their life to attacking other people on the Internet, basically trying to make that other person's life miserable in some way.
They send things to my home. It terrifies me to think what they could do if they wanted to, knowing exactly where I live, knowing where my children go to school.
Trolls can be a minor annoyance or a life-crippling terror. But what happens if society tries to silence them? Who loses then?
Trolling is a free speech issue, and if you aren't free to hate someone, then you're not free.
I've been associated with all kinds of organized trolling groups. We're stretching the bounds of free speech. You either use it or you lose it. Feelings will be hurt.
Politicians and the courts are now grappling with who really is a dangerous troll.
I've been called troll by very powerful people that should know better. Homophobe, misogynist, racist, all this stuff is just lazy people not wanting to interact.
Artist Gregory Allen Elliott is at the center of a landmark trolling case that might land him behind bars and forever change what any of us, anywhere, can or cannot say online.
If Mr. Elliott is convicted of a criminal offense, watch out. Nobody will be safe. You better shut up, because if you don't, he could be going to jail.
Gina's blog earns her family a decent income. She writes about being a stay-at-home mom, but from a pro-choice, modern feminist perspective. And a large, active community of like-minded women has grown around her blog.
I like to see that recognition response when someone else goes, oh, me too. And that's so validating. That's why I do it.
Psychologists and psychiatrists have been somewhat taken back by the huge amount of negativity there appears to be on the internet. And it may be that the internet has unleashed a kind of dark demon within millions of people out there in the general public. We think that one of the things that's problematic about the internet is it normalizes extreme behavior. So because you see a lot of people on the internet behaving in an extreme fashion, you think it's more normal than it might actually be. And the other thing is it seems to encourage a herd-like piece of behavior. If one person starts being negative and a group of people pile in behind them, there's a kind of cascade effect, which you don't see in ordinary life outside of the internet.
Hounding people when they are most vulnerable, like at the time of a loved one's funeral, is a surefire hit for the troll.
That's the easiest way for us to create a mass effect. It's really effective when you have all these people who are already emotional. Drop this bomb on them, you know, with the gore photos, maybe some kind of sexually explicit photos. It sends their emotions into overdrive.
But what do the trolls get out of seeing these distraught reactions?
I was a grad student in 1993 at Concordia University in Montreal. Essentially, at that time, the internet was still very nascent, and at that point was just a relatively small number of universities that were connected together. And there was this kind of quasi-bulletin board system called the News Network. You had, for example, a group like Rec.Humor, and people would trade jokes, and I guess what happened at some point was that there were people on Rec.Humor who had a certain penchant for tasteless jokes that was not appreciated by the rest of the community. And so the tasteless denizens were kind of hived off and started their own group, and Alt.Tasteless was born.
When I used Twitter, I used it as pure form. As an artist, I just went, this is a brush, this is some paint, this is a canvas. I used it to comment on politics. I used it to help people. But I just used it every way possible. One day I responded to every tweet that came across my tweet stream. And then someone said, you don't have to respond to everything. And I said, I know, right? But today that's what I'm doing as an artist and an experimenter.
At one point, Gregory was sending 300 tweets per day. He was acerbic, sometimes crude, and very opinionated. Inevitably, he made some enemies who wanted to shut him up. Chris Murphy, Gregory's lawyer, explains how Gregory went from volunteering to design a logo for a feminist organization to being arrested and jailed for 3 days.
When Greg called me, he had no idea why the police were there, and neither did I, obviously. And it wasn't until sometime after his arrest, when he was in custody, that he first learned what the police were doing there. And it turned out that there was a woman named Steph Guthrie who had said that Mr. Elliott had been criminally harassing her on Twitter. The medium that Mr. Elliott is alleged to have harassed the complainant, Ms. Guthrie, is on Twitter. That's it. No personal emails, not Facebook, nothing in person, no in-person meetings, no stalking behavior.
There's the one they threw coffee on. You can throw coffee on it, but creating the picture is worth more than 1,000 people destroying it. This is like freedom of speech. This is saying, you know, like, I can comment on what you're doing. As long as it's not a threat, you know, if you're hurt, if the truth hurts you, it's not my problem, because I'm just telling the truth.
Mr. Elliott was disagreeing with Stephanie Guthrie's politics. She's the founder of a political organization in Toronto called Women in Toronto Politics. Mr. Elliott was an ally of hers for a number of months, but then there was a break in the relationship because Mr. Elliott stuck up for someone he believed was being bullied by Ms. Guthrie and her friends on Twitter.
Ms. Guthrie, who refused to be interviewed for this film, asked her followers to, quote, sick the internet on a young man who had made an anti-feminist video game, a game that even Mr. Elliott admits was clearly offensive.
There was an orchestrated and dangerous attack on this guy. Right up to that point, I was sending tweets to them saying, look, the guy only has 11 followers. Ignore it. It's not good branding, you know, to destroy people's lives. But they said, "Screw you, Greg." And I said, "Okay, well, you're not going to take me seriously. You're not going to stop." I sent a tweet that I'm going to paraphrase it. It said, "If you commit suicide, I'm holding you all responsible." And at that point, my helping stopped, the attack started, and I had to start defending.
Gregory didn't know what he was up against. A community had labeled him a troll, and they were determined to get rid of him.
I knew they were trying to get me kicked off Twitter. So at first it was a campaign of intimidation. Second, it was fake identities, using my face and names that were similar to my names, and that's illegal. And if I had felt like it, I could have got whoever did it kicked off Twitter. But then it was the hashtag GAEhole, Gregory Allen Elliott, so gay hole. So this was an orchestrated campaign that ramped up.
Gregory fought back with tweets that were often abrasive and confrontational, but he never broke Twitter's terms of service. That hasn't stopped the justice system from charging him with criminal harassment and imposing bail conditions, taking away his internet use for 3 years.
So what I've had to do for the 3 years, because I was banned from the internet and banned from email, is I've had to rely on family and friends and try and cut into their lives and schedules. Yeah, and to be forced back onto a pencil and erasers is very interesting.
I've spent, I couldn't even count, thousands of hours like this, sitting like this, out of my own time, because he was not able to do his own evidence gathering for his case.
So you have to, the most painful thing is having to go through stream of consciousness blather on Twitter. Not exciting for me, and I can imagine it's even less exciting for everyone that was helping me out. So,
sifting through the intricate web of thousands of tweets and retweets made one thing abundantly clear to Gregory's lawyer, Chris Murphy.
Gregory Allen Elliott is not a troll. There's no way. He is either communicating a political message or he's defending himself against their slander. Those two things do not make you a troll. Wasn't going near them physically, wasn't saying anything threatening, wasn't saying anything sexual to them. He was communicating about politics, and he was following the rules on Twitter.
But because Gregory wouldn't shut up, his accusers went to the police, saying that they felt threatened. Now Gregory waits for the judge to decide his fate. Freedom or 6 months behind bars.
If Mr. Elliott is convicted of a criminal offense, watch out, because nobody will be safe. What you're going to do if you're involved in a political conversation online and the mob comes to shut you up, you better shut up, because if you don't, you could be going to jail.
Internet trolling has two essential parts: the attack and your reaction. A big reaction is what the trolls crave, and the way you respond determines whether or not you are a worthwhile target.
If it's just somebody that's just going to, you know, block us, and that's the end of the game, well, you guys suck. That doesn't provide too much entertainment.
Prolific troll Wild Goose and the Wagoner crew are all about the lulls, the laughs their victims provide. They call them lulls cops. So there's a logical limit to how far they'll push them.
There's a symbiotic relationship between the internet troll and the lulz cow. The Bill Wagoner crew has never pushed anyone towards suicide, nor have we tried to. That's never our intent. Why would we kill a perfectly good lulz cow? If we were to knock them off the internet or out of real life, what benefit would that provide us? You know, how are we going to get any lulz out of someone who's 6 feet underground? You know, last I looked, dead people don't come on the internet.
Stay-at-home mom and professional blogger Gina Crossley Corcoran faces a politically motivated faction among her trolls. They disagree with her opinions on home birth, breastfeeding, and the healthcare system. And they want to drive her blog off the internet altogether.
I have a large reach, but I don't feel like it somehow makes me better than anybody or makes me some sort of powerful figure, but they see it as very powerful, and that's why they want to shut it down.
A few years ago, a coordinated trolling campaign drove away all of Gina's sponsors.
There were a couple of brands that hung on, but ultimately they were like, listen, these people are flooding our Facebook page with negative comments and hateful comments and talking about our families now, and we just can't do it. So suddenly, almost overnight, I had no income base, but I had what had become an expensive blog to run.
Gina took a chance and put up a paywall. Fortunately, it turned out that most of her audience was willing to pay to be part of the feminist breeder community. But the frustrated trolls have since stooped to new lows.
One of them called the police and told them that I was committing suicide. So the police showed up at my house at like 3 a.m, woke me up out of bed, and said, we got an anonymous tip that you are suicidal and we have to put you under a 72-hour psych hold. So I was being thrown in the back of an ambulance, crying, you know, upset, afraid my children were going to wake up and see mommy being taken away. Luckily, I was able to talk to the EMT, and I explained to him, like, listen, this person you're saying from Twitter, this person doesn't know me. Please don't take me anywhere. I have kids to wake up to in the morning. And luckily, he sort of saw the situation for what it was, and he, you know, let me out of the ambulance and said, okay, go back to bed. So I found out from the police that anyone can make a call and say that they're worried about you committing suicide, or they're worried about your children's welfare, or and anyone can make an anonymous tip. They don't have to leave their name. So there's really nothing, legally speaking, that I can do about that. My trolls realized that was a good way to use my own local police to harass me and get me out of bed at 3 a.m. In the course of a year, it happened 3 times. So I went to the police and I said, this has to be illegal. And, you know, the local police's response was basically, well, if you don't like it, get off the internet.
When the police cannot or will not help, there is another place that trolling victims can turn.
Nice to meet you.
Please come have a seat.
The victims I deal with come to us very frustrated. They're frustrated with the situation because they feel helpless.
Roman Horak is lead forensic investigator at InfoTransic, an international cybersecurity firm. He tracks down the trolls that law enforcement won't or can't find.
The reasons why the police won't engage the case is because they won't believe there's enough of a serious threat, or they won't have the person themselves won't have enough evidence.
I've been getting a lot of people threatening me online, and it's scary. I'm not really sure what to do with this.
What sites mainly are they threats coming through on?
Mostly Twitter, but there's a couple on Facebook.
Okay. One of the big questions is understanding the motive of the troll. There's some trolls out there just scrolling the internet looking for someone random to, you know, harass. However, the vast majority of trolls that we deal with are someone who they know. They would have had a relationship somehow with the offender.
Indeed, in the course of their investigations, Roman and his team have discovered that it is people we know, family and friends and workmates, who are most often behind the heinous attacks we can face. But Roman's team has also uncovered a new, more dangerous type of player in the trolling game. Professional trolls. Those who can be hired to settle a score and attack others for money.
Online trolls for hire. The service is available online, almost like a hitman. Some of the guys are very professional. They even create their own malware targeted to that victim. So they write their own code. And these guys know what they're doing. These trolls for hire could be pretty much anywhere in the world, Romania or Ukraine, Russia, lots from there. Trying to track them down often becomes an international operation, having to coordinate between different law enforcement in different countries.
But thankfully, the vast majority of trolls are outright amateurs who don't really know how to cover their tracks.
About 85% of people who are doing these things, you know, trolling and harassing people online, are not tech savvy. Most offenders are leaving a vast amount of digital evidence every day. Every second, every minute right now. Pretty much everything we do online is potentially archived.
Many trolls operate with a false sense of security about their anonymity and of the potential consequences they face if exposed. In England, the law has taken a hard stance and a